You climbed the stairs and went back up to your bedroom. You closed the door. I wonder how long you'll stay there.
Good for you, Leo, the lady cop says now.
I shrug. It's not like she was that hard to find.
Dad tells her.
I should have called and told you you didn't need to come, but we just found her a couple minutes ago. There wasn't time. I silently call bullshit. It's been at least 15 minutes since Dad sent you upstairs. Plenty of time to call the lady cop off.
No, it's fine. You know I'm always here for you whenever you need me, Josh.
She's staring at him. Their hands are still touching. Inside, I gag. I don't announce that I'm going to bed. I just leave, though there's no chance I'm going to sleep. I don't go into my room. I take a seat at the top of the stairs instead. I listen to what they say. One thing I've figured out about the lady cop is that she has two voices. She has her cop voice, in which she thinks she's pretty badass. That's the one I always hear at the police station. And then there's her lady voice, which is the exact opposite of this. It's eager to please. Tonight, her lady voice showed up.
So tell me, how's it been going having Delilah home?
Their voices are hushed from the distance. Dad's chilled out some from his near heart attack upstairs, but I can tell that his nerves are still frayed. After he got you back upstairs, he cracked open a cold one and finished it in 2 minutes flat. I'd be lying if I said everything was perfect. It's far from perfect. She's not right, Carmen.
Of course she's not.
She's suffered greatly.
She has. And you have too.
No one mentions me and my suffering. It's been over a decade that she's been gone. She's not my little girl anymore. Don't get me wrong. I'm ecstatic to have her home. Relieved and overjoyed. I keep having to remind myself that this is real. That Delilah is actually home. That this isn't just another dream I'll wake up from in the morning, as I have hundreds of times since she disappeared. She's here, and no one's ever going to take her away from me again. We'll get there, he says. We'll get to a place where things feel normal.
A new normal. Things may never be how they used to be.
You did this, you know.
Did what?
This. You brought my baby girl back home to me. You never gave up on her. On us. You told me you'd keep looking until you found her. And now you have. I can't ever thank you enough for this, Carmen.
I was just doing my job.
You went above and beyond. You are still, he says. And then it's quiet for a long time. Too long. In my perverted mind, I see them sucking face, even though I've never actually witnessed anything more intimate than their sappy texts and the occasional hug. But how would I know what they do when left to their own devices? They're two lonely grown-ups, after all. The man has needs, even if the idea of it makes me want to puke. You're making noise in your room. I don't know what you're doing in there, but I know you're awake. I push myself off the floor. I go to your door. I knock. And then, because I think me knocking might scare the bejesus out of you, I call through the door.
It's me, Leo.
Your side of the door goes quiet. If I had to guess, I'd say you're standing there, trying to talk yourself into letting me in. How do you know that you can trust me? How do you know I'm not here to do something bad? I don't blame you for being scared. I knock again. It takes some time for you to open up the door. You don't say anything when you do. You just stand there, looking uptight.
Why aren't you asleep? I ask.
You don't say. You're still wearing the hospital clothes. For whatever reason, you don't want to put mine on. What are you doing in here? I ask. I look around to see what you've been up to, but the room is mostly dark. I can't see much. You give your head a little shake. Your hair falls into your eyes. It's slumpy. You've got a smell to you. You need a shower. But Dad thought you'd had enough for one day, so a shower will have to wait until tomorrow.
Nothing, sir,
you say. Leo, I tell you, getting annoyed now. It's Leo. Leo, I say, because
Maybe you don't know how to pronounce it or something. I could wear a name tag to help you remember, but I don't want to be a dick and assume you know how to read. Say it with me. Lee-O. You say my name. I think there's going to be something deja vu-ish about it when you finally do, but there's nothing. Not the spark of recollection I'd been hoping for. See? That wasn't so hard, was it? You don't say either way. Why aren't you sleeping? You don't tell me. Just can't sleep? You don't say. I think it would be hard trying to sleep in a place that's brand new, surrounded by people you don't know. You were asleep in the basement, until Dad went and put an end to that. Stay here, I say. I'll be right back. I go to my room. Kicked to the back corner of the closet floor is my old security blanket. It's blue. The silk edge is torn. Why I still have this stupid thing is beyond me. I used to go everywhere with it. I'd cry without it. According to Dad, Mom used to have to dupe me to get it out of my hands long enough to wash it. Once, it got left in the grocery store shopping cart, and my world almost came to an end. I'm thinking maybe you need my blanket more than I do. I half expect your bedroom door to be shut and locked when I come back. It's not. I thrust the blanket at you. Take it, I say. What is it? You ask, feeling the texture of it, the weight. The thing's been washed so many times, it's anything but soft. It's thin. It isn't the kind of thing that would keep anybody warm. It doesn't look like much. My old blankie. My blanket. Some kids have them. Maybe you did too, I don't know. I couldn't sleep without that thing as a kid. You don't say anything. You just hold my blanket in your hands, staring blankly at it. Then me. Then it. Cause you can't hold someone's stare more than a second at best. I thought maybe it would help you, you know, sleep. It used to be the only thing that made me feel better when I was sick or sad. I turn my back to you and start walking away. 3 steps later, you say, "Don't you need it?" Then you tack on, "Leo?" The way you say it is unsure, like you're not 100% sure you should say it. It gets a smile out of me, though you don't see. I keep walking. I think you need it more than me.
Kate, 11 years before. May. As promised, B and I drive to the babysitter's to pick Leo up. We park on the street, then walk to the door, sharing an umbrella. When we reach the door, it sounds like mass chaos on the other side. I wrap my knuckles against the door. When that fails to get anyone's attention, I pound. Charlotte, the babysitter, comes. As she draws the door slowly open, I catch a glimpse at the anarchy on the other side. A TV is on, volume loud, but no one watches it. Instead, a group of kids play Simon Says while another plays tag. They chase each other in circles around the living room, leaping on furniture whenever necessary to get away from it. It's madness to play tag inside, and yet it's raining outside. And even if it wasn't raining, the ground is sopping wet from days of rain. It's too wet to play in. I try and get a head count, but the children are constantly on the move. They're impossible to count. If I had to guess, I'd say more than a dozen, including the one who hangs from Charlotte's leg, wanting a ride. The kids are hysterical, slap happy. I have to look a while to find Leo. He sits by himself at a small table in the corner of the room. He pieces together a puzzle alone. The kids run circles around him. One knocks into the table. It's by accident only, and yet it's careless, insensitive. It's a little girl who does it, taller than Leo by a head. If she knows what she's done, she doesn't apologize. She keeps running, laughing, while Leo's puzzle goes flying to the floor. The pieces separate. No one but Leo and me notice. Leo's face falls, but he doesn't cry. He looks so small in comparison to the others as he scooches his chair out and drops to his knees, reclaiming the fallen puzzle pieces. "Can I help you?" Charlotte asks, peering at Bea and me through the screen. I let my gaze fall from Leo, feeling sad. Charlotte's hair is gray. Her eyes are gray. She has deep-set wrinkles around her mouth and under her eyes, made worse when she smiles, which she does. She has a kind smile. We're here to pick up Leo, I say. Leo Dickey? In case, in this mayhem, there's more than one Leo. Yes, of course, she says. Josh called and told me you'd be coming. The weather. Charlotte complains, leaning in closer to be able to speak over the noise. Usually I'd have the kids downstairs, but the darn sump pump went out yesterday, and the basement flooded. Oh no, how awful, I say. What a mess. We had a new one put in, but the basement is in the process of drying out. It will take a while. There are fans everywhere, but even after it's dry, we'll need repairs before the kids can go back down. Being cooped up inside like this, she says, turning to look at the kids. It's making the children stir crazy, all that pent-up energy. They need to get outdoors and play. She calls across the room for Leo. He's still on his knees, picking up fallen puzzle pieces. He glances up at the sound of Charlotte's voice, seeing Bee and me through the screen door. A slow smile spreads across his lips, and Bee waves. Like a good boy, Leo finishes gathering his puzzle to put it away before he leaves. Charlotte hugs him before he goes, confessing to Bee and me. He's my favorite. I wish all the kids were as well-behaved as him. I wonder if she says this to all of the kids. Charlotte opens the door and Leo steps outside with us. We make our way to the car. Leo is quiet, as always. He doesn't ask about Josh, Meredith, or Delilah. Still, Bee says something glib about why we're not going to his home. Delilah's sick, Leo tells us at random. Bee says, Yep, buddy, that's right, Delilah's sick. It doesn't feel right lying to Leo. At home, Bee makes dinner for Leo and me. She lets Leo help. They make pasta. Bee serves it with milk for Leo, a glass of wine for me. She makes an extra plate to save for Josh, not that he will eat it. We sit at the table and eat. Bee tries to get Leo to open up about his day. He isn't very forthcoming. When Bee asks if he likes it there at Charlotte's, tears well in his eyes. He doesn't answer with words. He doesn't need to. I finish my glass of wine and Bee brings me another. She switches topics to something more light. She and Leo get lost in a discussion of superheroes with the best superpowers. I don't join in. My mind is elsewhere, circling on three things. What is happening at Josh and Meredith's house? Who did Cassandra see on the Dickey's lawn that night? How can I meet Dr. Feingold for myself? We're playing charades when Josh comes for Leo. We're in the living room. The TV is on, but muted. For the last hour or so, Bee and I have watched the news ticker at the bottom of the screen, warn us that we're under a severe thunderstorm watch. As I open the door for Josh, I see that the world outside has turned ominous. It's late and dark. He was with the police for hours. I welcome Josh in, pressing the door closed against the weight of the urgent wind. Josh rushes to Leo, where he scoops him into his arms. They talk about Leo's day. Leo asks where Mommy is. Josh hesitates, and I feel for him, having to come up with an answer to Leo on the spot. As with Bee, it's a lie. The truth would be too much for Leo to handle right now, especially when none of the adults in his life know what the truth is. Where is Meredith? Mommy is at work, he says.
When will Mommy be home?
He asks. His voice is small, discreet, like he doesn't want Bee and me to hear.
You know how it goes, Leo? Josh says. Sometimes we don't know when Mommy will be home from work, but she'll be home as soon as she can. I promise you that.
We let Leo pick out a cartoon. Once he's fully immersed in it, Bee, Josh, and I slip into the kitchen where we can speak in private. What happened? I ask Josh. I go to the refrigerator, offer him a beer. Bee warms his dinner and brings it to the table, though as expected, he doesn't eat. Josh looks beat, disheveled, undone. He hasn't shaved in 2 days. I'm not entirely sure he slept or showered. He says reluctantly.
They found Meredith's pills.
I know what he means by this. I know what the implication is. They're blaming the victim.
I get angry for Josh and Meredith. Did they have a warrant to search your house? He shakes his head, says remorsefully,
They didn't need one, Kate. I gave them permission to search. I didn't think we had anything to hide. We don't have anything to hide.
I get it. For Josh, the invasion of privacy was worth it if it meant the police finding something that might tip them off about Meredith and Delilah's whereabouts. He just didn't expect them to draw certain conclusions when they found Meredith's pills in the medicine cabinet. Meredith struggled with postpartum depression after Leo was born. She wasn't ashamed of it. She didn't try and keep it a secret. In fact, she was unapologetic and unreserved, appreciating how her own experience made her better at what she does. Meredith saw a therapist for a while and was put on antidepressants. The antidepressants helped. She was in no rush to get off them, because if they were working, then why would she be? So what? I ask, wondering what Meredith's antidepressants have to do with anything.
They asked a lot of questions about her mental health, about whether she's ever tried to hurt herself or one of the kids.
My God, B says, her hand going to her heart. The media has sensationalized postpartum depression, made it out to seem like all women who suffer are the kind to kill their children. It's not true. Postpartum psychosis is something else. It's different and rare, and even of those affected, only a small percentage do something violent. I know because Meredith told me. She talked once about writing a blog about the experiences of women, and this was one of the things she considered writing about. Postpartum psychosis both fascinated and saddened her. What did you tell them? I ask.
I told them no, of course not. Meredith is the most sound person I know. Ask anyone, I said.
Josh tells us, and it's true. Meredith has always been the glass half full type. She teaches yoga, she meditates. She rarely has a bad thing to say about anyone else. She's a good person. She's not capable of hurting her kids under any circumstance. The police are way off base if they think Meredith has done something to Delilah, I say. I'm getting worked up. I'm angry. The wine hasn't helped because I feel less inhibited, free to say whatever I want. But the police are wasting time if they think Meredith did this. Josh takes a big, long swig of his beer and says,
There's more.
He's guarded as he says it. Quiet. He sinks back into his chair, takes another long drink from the bottle, and sets it slowly down. He wipes at his mouth with the back of a hand, his eyes focused on the wood grain of the table, avoiding B and me.
They found blood, he says.
And only then do his blue eyes rise slowly up. There's a sudden heaviness in my stomach. I push my glass of wine away, no longer able to drink from it. Josh's words make me instantly sober up.
Blood.
Where? I ask. B leans forward to hear.
In the garage.
You hadn't noticed? I ask. Josh shakes his head.
It's dark in the garage. One of the bulbs is burned out. I keep forgetting to fix it. It's not what you're imagining, he explains. There wasn't a ton of blood, Kate. Even after the police pointed it out for me,
he says.
It was still hard to see.
But it was there, I say, voice drifting. What do they think? B asks. She's standing at the head of the table, hands on the top rail of the backrest. Beside Josh, I sit. I reach my hand out and touch his. He takes my hand into his and holds it for a minute. Neither of us speak. I can't imagine what he is going through. His hand trembles in mine. I doubt that Josh has had anything to eat all day, and a beer on an empty stomach can't be good. I let go of his hand, push his plate of pasta closer, and encourage him to eat. To appease me, he takes a couple of bites before setting the fork down.
They're seeing if it's Delilah's or Meredith's,
he says about the blood.
We should know soon.
I wonder what good knowing this will do. I think if anything, it will make Josh, in addition to Meredith, look bad, more victim-blaming. It's as if Josh can read my mind. He confesses.
They asked where I was that day, if someone at work could vouch for me.
An alibi? B asks, and he nods his head. They think you did something to her?
I don't know what they think,
he tells us. They're just doing their jobs, he says. And I admire his diplomacy. It would be easy to understand why he might get upset. I would be upset. I would be raging. But Josh doesn't get upset.
I have an alibi, if that's what you're wondering,
he says. But he's tight-lipped about it, unforthcoming. This suggests to me that Josh was doing something he shouldn't have been doing. My heart hurts. Was Josh seeing someone else? Was Josh cheating on Meredith? What were you doing? B hesitantly asks, thinking the same thing as me.
It sounds so shallow in retrospect,
he says. And she has to ask again, more insistent this time. Where were you yesterday, Josh? He takes a deep breath, slowly exhales.
Playing tennis,
he says, describing for us the very she exclusive club where they play. He's ashamed, knowing now that while something terrible was happening to Meredith and Delilah, he was having a doubles match with a prospective client. He wasn't having an affair.
I won. Not that it makes any difference now.
He swallows hard, keeping his emotions at bay. I don't think he'd cry with Leo just in the next room. For Leo's sake, he has to be strong.
You can't beat yourself up about it,
B tells him, relieved like me to know that he wasn't with some other woman. Not in the way we thought, at least.
You didn't know.
There's no way you could have known, I echo. B changes the subject. She brings up the body found down there by the river's edge. Shelby's body. Josh says it's something that will haunt him for the rest of his life. He won't ever get that image out of his mind. An autopsy would still need to be done, but speculation was that she'd been dead at least a couple of days. I've seen animals dead a couple of days. It must have been horrific for Josh. Seeing Shelby's whole body expanded in size due to the buildup of gases inside. I just thank God it wasn't Meredith he had to see that way. Do they think her husband killed her? I ask.
No one said.
We heard she was naked.
Mostly, yes,
he says.
But she was covered up with a blanket.
A blanket? B asks. She's surprised, as am I. It's unexpected. It strikes me as an affectionate, intimate thing to do. Not the kind of thing a ruthless killer would do. Unless, of course, the murderer knew his victim and had a fondness for her. Then he might do something like cover her up with a blanket. I think of Bea in my conversation with Jason Tebow, with the midwife and what we learned about Dr. Feingold. How much does Meredith tell you about her clients? I ask.
What do you mean?
Did you know Shelby was a client of hers? The look on Josh's face is clear. He didn't know.
Meredith left her clients' names out of it when we talked about them. Their privacy was important to her. She'd tell me when a husband was being an ass or about a baby born with some abnormality, but she never called them by name.
Then you didn't know that the Tebows are suing their obstetrician for malpractice. Meredith is to testify in a deposition against him, I say. The color fades from Josh's face.
How do you know?
He asks, and I tell him. He looks at us in disbelief, his eyes going back and forth between B's and mine. He asks.
You spoke to Jason Tebow? You should be more careful. He could be dangerous. What if he killed Shelby?
He asks.
How do you know he wouldn't have killed you too?
B and I say nothing. Josh runs his fingers through his hair. The realization that Meredith might have gotten herself into something high risk scares him. I can see the disbelief in his eyes. The worry. Once upon a time, Meredith told him everything. Even if she kept her client's confidentiality, testifying against this doctor was something she should have told him.
What do you think then?
He asks.
That this obstetrician did something to both of them? And Delilah too?
I don't know, I say. We're just telling you what we know, Josh. I say it softly because I know that he's scared. He's beside himself, barely keeping it together. He isn't trying to be argumentative or defensive. I'm scared too. He inhales deeply, slowly lets the air out.
Maybe, Josh says, thinking aloud. That's what Mr. Tebow wants you to think. Maybe it's a lie.
It's possible, of course. I don't know Jason Tebow. I have no reason to believe anything he said was true. In my mind, both men are equally culpable. But Jeanette, the midwife, corroborated much of what he said. What reason would she have to lie?
We don't know what to think, Josh,
Bea says.
God willing, Meredith and Delilah are fine. Completely and absolutely fine.
Still, I say, hating to be the alarmist, but it's something that can't be ignored. The connection between Shelby and Meredith, the fact that they knew each other, it's concerning, right? I ask. They both look at me and stare, no one wanting to face the fact that it's more than just concerning. What it means is that, with Shelby now dead, Meredith and Delilah are in serious trouble. We need to find them soon, if it's not too late for them already.
Meredith, 11 years before. March.
Good morning,
Josh says as he appears in the kitchen doorway in a slim-fit, dark gray suit. He smiles at me, looking smart, competent. I stand at the stove, already showered and dressed, making pancakes and bacon for Josh and the kids. Josh comes to me. He wraps his arms around me from behind, and I get a whiff of him, of his shaving cream and his cologne.
How'd you sleep?
He asks me. Okay, I say, though I didn't sleep well. Now I'm up early, feeling anxious, wanting to know if Shelby is all right after her text last night. I keep checking my phone, but it's quiet. It has been since shortly after 3 a.m. How about you? I ask, turning to face him. How do you sleep?
Like a baby,
he says, kissing me. His kiss isn't rushed. It goes on far longer than the usual peck, which is all we ever have time for before we're interrupted by kids. His kiss is tender, unhurried, and I find myself thinking how much I miss this, something as commonplace as kissing my husband. Everything else falls by the wayside. For one blissful minute, the anxiety of the last few days abates. And then, from upstairs, I hear a toilet flush. The first sign of life. Delilah or Leo, whoever is up, will be down soon. Josh draws slowly away, still smiling. What do you have on tap for today? I ask, and he tells me.
Finalizing a deal with a prospective client. Hopefully.
He and his team have been working on this pitch for some time. It would mean the world to Josh and his career to land this client. What time is the meeting?
11.
Good luck, I tell him. Not that you need it. Josh is incredibly good at what he does. He's climbed the corporate ladder more quickly than most.
Thanks,
he says, then asks,
do you have a client in labor?
No, why?
Your phone, he says. I heard a text come in the middle of the night.
Oh. Of course he did. I remember him drawing away, pulling the covers over his head to block the phone's light. Braxton Hicks, I lie, saying that a client thought she was in labor, but she's not. It can be confusing for first-time mothers. The contractions are not as intense as real contractions. They don't come at regular intervals. They don't progress. I often have to talk these women out of thinking they're in labor. It doesn't matter, though, because it's a lie. None of my clients is currently experiencing Braxton Hicks contractions. I don't like lying to Josh. It isn't something that happens often. In fact, it never happened. Not until about 6 months ago when Josh started to get more apprehensive about my job. It began with a random carjacking. A young woman was stopped in town at a red light near midnight. During the day, it's a busy intersection. There's a grocery store, a gym, Walgreens. But at that time of night, it was vacant. Everything around was closed. Two masked men approached the car at gunpoint. They made the woman get out of the car. They assaulted her first, before stealing her car. They left with her phone, her purse, her ID. She couldn't call for help. She walked 3 miles home in the dark. They never found the people who did it to her. It left Josh scared for my safety. He's overprotective as a result. He wishes I was a stay-at-home mom like Cassandra. "We don't need the money," Josh has said. It's a conversation we've had often. He does it because he loves me, because he doesn't want anything bad happening to me. I get that. I love him even more for it. But I also love my job.
"Is she okay?"
Josh asks, meaning my client with Braxton Hicks. "She's fine. It's unsettling," I tell him. "The unknown. But she's 40 weeks yesterday. She'll go into labor soon."
"How long did she keep you up?"
he asks, looking at me, sizing up my eyes. They're tired. Heavy. I'm on my third cup of coffee. "Not long."
"You're a good person,"
Josh says, before he leaves for work. I hate how we're always rushing off in opposite directions. I also feel guilty for lying to Josh. But what he doesn't know won't hurt him. I'm lying to protect him. To protect Shelby. To protect my career. Through the window, Delilah sees Cassandra, Piper, and Arlo leave for school. She gets upset because of it. She wants to leave too. She wants to walk to school with Piper. But we can't leave yet because I can't find one of Leo's shoes. "Help me look," I tell Delilah, and she does. She finds it hidden behind the kitchen curtains. Leo won't sit still long enough for me to put it on. By the time we make it outside, Cassandra and family are gone. They're too far ahead to catch, even if we ran. "Don't worry, you'll see her at school," I tell a pouting Delilah. Leo and I walk Delilah the few blocks to school. We take her to the corner where parents congregate, watching as the crossing guard gets the children across the street and to the red brick building on the other side. Delilah makes us walk quickly to try and catch Piper before she crosses the street. She wants to walk into school with her. But by the time we arrive, Piper has already crossed the street. Even worse, she's walking hand in hand with another little girl from school, Lily Morris. Lily Morris is in Piper and Delilah's kindergarten class. Delilah is upset because she has to wait for the crossing guard to allow her to cross. But the crossing guard is letting traffic pass now. She has to wait. I feel badly for her, having to watch these other girls walk into the building without her, feeling left out. Friendships are hard. I lean down and whisper in her ear, "You'll catch up with them in class. It will be fine, honey. You'll see." Cassandra and Arlo stand at the corner. I'd go over and say hello, but Cassandra is caught up in a conversation with Lily Morris's mother, Amber. I don't like Amber any more than Delilah likes Lily. Lily, according to Delilah, is not nice. She's mean. She won't ever play with Delilah.
She makes fun of the kids. She calls them things like stupid and dumb. I watch as Piper and Lily make it inside the building. Their mothers turn away, stepping past me. I hear the word playdate as they do, and I stiffen in reply. Piper and Lily are having a playdate without Delilah. I don't want to get caught up in kindergarten drama, but she's my daughter. If she's being excluded, she'll be sad. Delilah's happiness means everything to me. Hi, Cassandra, I say. I reach out to touch her arm as she sweeps by. It's a reflex. Cassandra turns to me and says, Oh, Meredith, I didn't see you there. I find it hard to believe. There are only a dozen parents at the corner. And even now that she has, she doesn't stop and talk to me. She keeps walking with Lily's mother. I feel a stab of jealousy, of resentment, because Amber used to be the one Cassandra and I would talk about over coffee. How she's so over-involved in the PTO, how she thinks school bake sales are the end-all and be-all of life, her grandiose sense of self-importance. The tables have turned. I'd bet my life they're talking about me. I try not to dwell on it. I have enough friends. I don't need Cassandra to be my friend. Though I like Cassandra. I like her a lot. I'd be sad to lose her as a friend. The only reason Cassandra has for being angry anyway is one too many canceled coffee dates. It's a hazard of my job. Childbirth can't be planned. Cassandra knows this. She's always been tolerant. Until now. It's not like she could know about her husband, Marty, and me. Unless he told her. But he wouldn't do that. We'd agreed to keep things secret. For Cassandra's and Josh's sake. Leo and I watch Delilah walk across the street. And then we walk back to the house. We get in the car. I drive him to the babysitter's house. I put Cassandra out of my mind for now. I park on the street. Leo leaves his blanket in the car, though he never likes to be apart from it. He does so reluctantly, with the promise that I'll keep it safe while he's gone. I walk him to the front door. When the sitter Charlotte comes, Leo throws a fit. This happens sometimes, though it's relatively new. Some days, Leo goes willingly. But other days, he doesn't want to go to the sitter's house. He wants to stay with me. Mommy has to work, I say soothingly. I peel his arms from my leg and gently shove him into Charlotte's open arms. It feels awful to do this, to push my crying child away. In Charlotte's arms, his crying intensifies. My heart aches. Leo tries squirming away, coming back to me. There's a hitch to my voice. I choke back my own tears as I say, You'll have fun. You'll play with the other kids. Before you know it, Daddy will be here to pick you up, and then you'll be having so much fun you won't want to come home. It's only lately that Leo has had stranger anxiety. Of course, Charlotte is not a stranger. He's known her for months. She's far from a stranger. But these days, Leo only wants to be with Josh or me. We talked to the pediatrician about it. She said to give it time, that, like most things in our kids' lives, it's a passing phase. He'll be fine, Charlotte says. He always is after you leave. It's the same thing that the pediatrician said. Saying goodbye is the hardest part. I take comfort in that as I stand alone on her front porch, watching as Charlotte carries my crying child away and closes the door. From the other side, I hear him wail.
Delilah and Leo have been coming to Charlotte's house since Delilah started kindergarten this year. Before that, they attended a different daycare. I didn't love it. It had a clinical feel, nothing homey like this. Things got complicated, too, when Delilah started school. Then I needed a sitter who could pick her up at the end of the day, who could keep an eye on her until Josh came home. The school didn't provide a bus. Charlotte was that sitter, parading there with all the kids to pick them up, pulling the little ones in the red wagon. Until recently, the kids have been happy with her. I think of what the pediatrician said. A passing phase. This too shall pass. I turn my back to Charlotte's house. My next stop is Shelby's. I need to see with my own eyes if she's okay after her texts last night. I drive to Shelby's home. I leave my car on the street, behind a red sedan that's parked on the curb. I step out. I make my way to the front door and quietly knock. Shelby peels the door slowly back. She's still in her pajamas, from what I can tell, though the door blocks most of her body. I examine her face for signs of bruising. There are none. That said, she looks washed out. She wears no makeup. In the coffee shop, she had makeup. Today, she looks like she'd just rolled out of bed. I'm grateful to see her alive and seemingly unharmed. I breathe a sigh of relief. I never would have forgiven myself if something bad had happened. "What are you doing here?" Shelby asks. She's unable to hide the surprise. I'm the last person in the world she expected to see. Her voice is quiet. It's little more than a whisper. I'm relieved that there are no visible bruises. But I've heard that abusive spouses can be masters at hiding their handiwork. There may be bruises that I can't see. Or if her husband is abusing her, it could be emotional rather than physical. I'm not only worried for Shelby's sake, I'm worried for her unborn baby. A kick or a punch to her gut could easily end its life. I looked up photos of Mr. Tebow online. He's a large man. He looks mean. I say, "You didn't text back last night, Shelby. I was worried." Shelby looks vacant. Either she doesn't know what to say or she doesn't know what I mean. Her hair is mussed up, thrown into a sloppy ponytail. Her roots are shades darker than the rest of her hair. She says nothing apropos of what I've said. Instead, "How did you know where I live?" It's accusatory, almost. As if she thinks I've crossed a line. As if she thinks I'm stalking her. "It's on the contract, Shelby," I say. I can hear the patience in my voice start to wane. "You wrote your address on the contract." "I did?" she asks.
"You did."
"Oh," she says. "Right, I did. I just didn't think that you'd show up at my door." I tell her, "I don't usually show up at my clients' homes. This is a first for me. But I was worried," I say again. "After your text last night, I came to make sure everything was fine." I hear a man's voice in the background. It startles me. My insides tighten. I see the shadow of him loom at the top of the stairs. I swallow against a bulge in my throat. That must be him. Her husband, Jason. I hadn't expected him to be home. He calls for her, asks her to grab him a drink on her way up. The gap in the door gets smaller. Shelby is inching the door closed, inadvertent or not. His tone is brusque, but not necessarily mean.
Hey, Shell, bring me something to drink, would you?
I'll be there in a minute, she calls up the stairs. She looks to me, says anxiously, I have to go. She fully intends to close the door in my face. Before she can, my foot inches forward. It happens unintentionally, before I can think it through. My foot fills the door's narrowing crack so that she can't close it when she tries. What are you doing? Shelby asks, surprised. She looks down at my wedged foot. Her voice stays quiet, words hissed. She doesn't want him to know that I am here. I say flatly, You didn't tell me if you're all right.
Why wouldn't I be?
She asks, her tone immature. Shelby is in her early 20s. I thought I'd reached adulthood when I was that age. Now, over a decade later, I realize that at 23 or 24, I didn't know much of anything. I still had so much growing up to do, so much to figure out about how the world worked.
Because of your text messages, Shelby, you told me you were scared of your husband.
Oh, that, she says. I shouldn't have sent that. She runs her hands through her hair, pulls the rubber band out. Her hair falls around her shoulders. She shakes it out.
We had a stupid fight, that's all. I fired off some stupid text. I didn't mean it.
Then why did you say it? I ask, not sure if I believe her.
I was mad, she says.
You said you were scared.
He was yelling at me.
About what? I ask, not sure that she'll tell me.
It was stupid, she says.
I say nothing. I wait, seeing if she'll continue. And she does.
I spend too much money. He said I have crap for brains because I went and bought some new maternity shirts and got one of those prenatal massages. He says we're broke and I can't be wasting money like that, but he has no idea what it's like to be carrying around a baby all the time. He doesn't give a shit that I've outgrown my clothes.
Did he hurt you, Shelby? I ask.
He was really pissed off, she says.
I ask again. Did he hurt you?
Do I look hurt to you?
She doesn't. I don't know what to think. Maybe he did and maybe he didn't.
You coming, Shell?
He calls again, more brusquely this time, losing patience.
I haven't got all day to wait.
It's really nice of you to come check on me, Meredith, she says.
The rest of her words come quickly out, tumbling like a waterfall.
No one does kind things like this for me.
I lean in and whisper, talking fast.
Did he hurt you? You can tell me if he did. I can help.
I don't know what I'd do to help other than go to the police, but I'd do that for her. She doesn't answer.
You can talk to me.
I breathe the words through the doorway, withdrawing my foot to reach in and set my hand on hers. Her hand is cold.
I'm here for you, I say.
The grin on her face is very Stepford Wives.
You're sweet, Meredith, really sweet. I'm glad I found you, she says.
She drops my hand. She goes again to close the door. She still hasn't told me if she's all right. I try to stop her. Before I can, the door is shut.
Leo. Now. Dad takes you to a shrink. The shrink came recommended by the lady cop because she's worked with trauma victims before. I go because Dad needs my help getting you to the car. The reporters are hungry, and the walk to our garage
where the car is parked, is long. We leave out the back door. We make a run for it, but the reporters are ready and waiting. They're like vultures. They close in on us the second we're out the door. They call out questions. Dad tells them, "Your First Amendment rights don't give you permission to trample our lawn." He's cheesed off, but trying not to fly off the handle because the reporters would only get that on video and show it on TV. Still, Dad threatens to press trespassing charges. It takes a while for the two fat cops to get out of their car, shut down the reporters' inquisition, and get them off our lawn. Between Dad and me, you shake. You're not used to the pandemonium, to the sunlight, to the noise. Dad's got his hooded parka on you, and you hide beneath the hood like Little Red Riding Hood, looking scared as hell because the wolf is about to eat you alive. You've got my blanket with you, which makes me feel all sorts of things I've never felt inside. But I don't point it out because I don't want you to feel weirded out. And besides, externalizing feelings isn't my thing. So instead, I pretend that I don't see the blanket. When we get to the shrink's office, Dad and I stay in the waiting room, much to his chagrin. He planned to go in with you, but the shrink says no, that it would be better if Dad stays put. We never know what you talk about or don't talk about with her. She's got a white noise machine on the floor, so Dad and I can't hear what you say. I see Dad looking at it. I read his mind. He's thinking about pulling the plug, but he never does. This is what you told the police. You were kept in a locked basement by a man and a woman, who the cops now need to find. You don't know how you got there. You don't know much about your life before. You've blocked most of it out, though you have hazy memories of our house, Dad's face, the fact that Mom is dead. Dad's hoping the shrink can squeeze the rest of it out of you, especially your last minutes with Mom. He needs to know once and for all what happened. Dad's willing to try just about anything to make it so. Medicine, hypnosis. We go back to the police after seeing the shrink. The lady cop is waiting for us when we get there. "Can I talk to you, Josh?" she asks, and they disappear. I'm left with you. Someone else might try and make small talk with you, but I just stand there like some dope, not sure what to say. I should say something to make you feel better, but I can't find the words. Anything I might say would sound stupid, so I say nothing. Dad and the lady cop stand in the far corner of the room. She holds a file folder in her hands, but she never opens it. She does all of the talking. Dad's head nods. "What was that all about?" I ask when Dad comes back. "The DNA results." "What about them?" "It's her. She's your sister." I thought we already knew that. Today, when talking with the lady cop, you remember that the man's and the woman's names are Eddie and Martha. They're the ones who kept you. The lady cop asks if you can describe them, and you do, but it's fuzzy at best. Things like brown hair and a fat face. She gets a sketch artist to sit with you. Then she talks to Dad. She asks whether Mom knew anyone named Eddie or Martha. Mom didn't, as far as Dad knows. The lady cop thinks maybe this had something to do with money. Maybe Mom owed money to someone, and so they took you as payment. She asks Dad if Mom was in debt to anyone, if Mom had gotten in over her head. Did she have a history of gambling, a drug addiction? Was she selling? There's a thing with some suburban moms, selling prescription drugs like Vicodin and their kids' Adderall to make ends meet. It's been on the news. Dad has doubts. Even after all that's happened, he still hero worships Mom. Sure, she took you. She ended her own life. I kind of hate her for it. But he idolizes her. Meredith wouldn't have done that. I know that's what you want to believe, Josh, but we have to consider the possibilities. Mom hadn't been herself before it happened. Something went down that made her want to kill herself. We don't know what. Dad wonders aloud about a middleman. What if Mom put you somewhere safe, and then that person gave you away? That's the only way he can think that you would have ended up with Eddie and Martha. In an instant, Dad becomes obsessed with this idea of a middleman. There never was much of an investigation into what happened to Mom. When she was thought to be missing, there were a few suspects, like Dad. But as soon as it became apparent she offed herself, they were all suddenly innocent. Only Mom was to blame, even though there were things found during the investigation that the cops swept under the rug. After the coroner said suicide, the focus shifted to finding you. Except that Mom's note, "You'll never find her, don't even try," made the cops think Mom had given you to someone she knew, someone she trusted. The cops spoke to everyone Mom ever knew. There were never any leads. Back then, there was never any question of if someone stole you. Dad took comfort in that, even though he wanted you back. He stuck with that story my whole life, telling me and anyone who would listen how my big sister Delilah was in safe hands because Mom never would have let anything bad happen to you. It's the only way he could sleep at night. I'm starting to think that's not the way it went down.
Meredith. 11 years before. March. Dinner is in the oven. With classes to teach in the afternoon, I got a late start. Josh comes home from work with Delilah and Leo in tow, having picked them up from Charlotte's on the way home. How'd everything go with the kids, I ask. What I really mean is, how did everything go with Leo? Delilah would have been fine because she's always fine when she's away from us. She's playful and unreserved, always able to find a friend. But I want to know how Leo was when Josh picked him up. Had he stopped crying after I left? Of course he had. Charlotte would have called and told me if he hadn't. Wouldn't she? I would have canceled my classes, gone back and picked him up. It would have broken my heart for him to cry at Charlotte's all day.
Everything was fine, Josh says.
He's nonchalant about it. I have the disadvantage of dropping Leo off, of seeing him cry, of having to push him into another woman's arms for comfort. Josh gets to be the one to pick him up and bring him home. What were they doing when you got there? I ask.
Playing outside, he says.
This week is spring-like, sunny, warm. Winter has left us, though maybe not for good.
How long until dinner will be ready?
He asks. About 30 minutes, I tell him, asking how the pitch went today. It went well, Josh says, grinning from ear to ear. They landed the client.
I meant to call, he says, but the afternoon got away from me. There was a lot of celebrating.
I imagine they cracked open a bottle of champagne after the deal was finalized. I can see how thrilled Josh is, and I'm thrilled for him as a result. It's fine, I say. I go to him, feeling terrible that I didn't think to do something more special for him tonight, knowing when he left this morning that this deal was nearly a sure thing. I should have made his favorite dinner. I should have called the sitter and made reservations for Josh and me at the steakhouse in town. Instead, I'm making a rather prosaic baked chicken recipe that feels suddenly inadequate for Josh's good news. I'm just so happy for you, I say.
Happy for us, says Josh, still grinning.
We'll have some champagne with dinner, I say.
Sounds perfect.
He excuses himself to go upstairs and change. While waiting for the chicken to bake, I run a bath. Delilah goes first. She's in a mood.
Stupid Lily Morris, she says, pouting. I hate her.
Delilah plops herself down into the warm water. She does it with such ferocity the water splashes outside the tub. What did she do? I ask.
She's trying to steal my friend. She's a thief, Mommy. A friend thief.
Oh, honey, I say, my heart breaking for her. I wish I could tell her that in 5,
In 10 years from now, none of this will matter. That when she's 16, she won't even remember this little disappointment. But I don't want to trivialize her pain. Words like that are of little comfort to a sad 6-year-old. I'm sorry she upset you. Friendships can be hard. I ask, do you think you could all be friends?
Lily Morris doesn't like me, she complains.
She doesn't know you, that's all. She'd love you if she got to know you. How could she not? I ask, smiling at her. Maybe we could invite both Piper and Lily over for a playdate, I say. I tell her that we could make cookies, do a craft. I don't know when we'd find the time to do that. But Delilah likes that idea. It settles her. It gives her something to look forward to. We'll find the time. We'll make the time. Leo is up next. With Leo naked in the tub, I see the bruise on his bottom. It's about the size of a baseball. What happened? I gasp. I run a finger over it and he winces. It hurts to touch. The bruise is red. It's fresh. The area around it is swollen. It hasn't had a chance to turn purple. This bruise happened today. Did you bump into something? I ask Leo. He stares in reply. He says nothing. Either he doesn't know or he won't say. Do you remember, Leo, how this happened? I ask again. This time he shakes his head. Leo asks for his bath toys. I get them for him. But this time, when he lines his whale and fish up on the edge of the tub, they don't gracefully swan dive into the water as they usually do. Instead, they kick one another into the tub. It's aggressive, mean. The much bigger whale uses its big blue fin to firmly kick the tiny, unsuspecting red fish into the water. The fish falls, becomes submerged. But only for a moment, it floats back to the surface. Leo grabs the fish. He sets it back on the edge of the tub. It happens all over again. Leo, I say. My voice is more firm. Did someone do this to you? I ask, pointing for a third time to the bruise. Leo doesn't answer with words. Instead, he lifts a finger to his lips, says, "Shh." Suddenly, my heart is in my throat. Did someone do this to him and tell him not to tell? After I get him out of the bath, I call Charlotte. Charlotte should have told Josh at pickup if something happened to Leo. I ask Josh. She didn't. He goes to see the bruise for himself. Charlotte answers on the third ring. "Hi, Meredith," she says. Her voice is sing-song. Charlotte is older than me. She was a teacher once. She taught at an alternative school in town. It's what they call an in-lieu-of-expulsion program. Kids that would otherwise be expelled from their current schools get transferred there. Burnout is high. Charlotte didn't last long before she started her own in-home daycare. I tell Charlotte why I'm calling. I say what I saw in the bath. I ask, "Did Leo fall at your house? Did he get hurt? Do you know?" "Let me think," she says. Charlotte watches a number of kids. They range in age from 18 months to 12 years. The older kids, like Delilah, are in school most of the day. But at 3 o'clock, Charlotte and the others walk to pick them up. Then her number of charges doubles. It's organized chaos whenever I'm there. "No," Charlotte says after a short hiatus. "I don't remember anything happening to Leo. I didn't see anything happen. Leo didn't tell me if he got hurt." There's a pause. She asks, "Is that what he said, Meredith? That he fell at my house?" "No," I tell her. "He didn't say that. But I was just wondering, since he hasn't been home all day and he didn't have the bruise this morning. I don't mean for it to sound accusatory. I'd like to think Leo would have told me if he was hurt, Charlotte says. We could have put some ice on it. The way that she says it touches a raw nerve. She's blaming Leo. Maybe not for what happened, but for not coming to her for help. That said, I don't want to make more out of this than there is. He's a kid. Kids bump and bruise themselves all the time. Besides, Leo is the shrinking violet type. He would never have gone to Charlotte for comfort. That's outside his comfort zone. The only way Charlotte would have known is if Delilah saw it happen and told. Charlotte came recommended from nearly everyone in the neighborhood who has kids. She's a patient, loving, grandmotherly type, though she isn't a grandmother because she never had kids of her own. People that we know called her a godsend, an angel, the best. It doesn't get better than that. I say, I know you would have, Charlotte. I'll talk to Leo. Make sure he knows he can tell you if he ever gets hurt at your house again. I do talk to Leo, but it only settles me somewhat. Because the realization that harm can come to one of my kids when I'm not there to protect them still terrifies me.
Kate, 11 years before. May. The next morning, Bea walks in on me when I'm on the phone. I'm in the bedroom. I thought she was outside in her studio working, and so I didn't even try and be quiet. I had no intention of telling her what I had planned, knowing she'd try and talk me out of it if I did. "Did I get that right?" she asks from behind. I spin to face her. I hadn't heard her come in. She looks disappointed in me. She stands there, showered and dressed, while my own hair still wet from a shower air dries. I'm in a towel, hurrying to get dressed before the workers arrive and find me this way. Bea asks in disbelief, "You made an appointment with Dr. Feingold?" I go to my dresser. I riffle through it for something to wear, putting Bea off. I don't know how to respond to her, though it's not worth a lie. Bea and I aren't the type to lie to one another. But more than that, Bea heard what she heard. She knows what I've done. I step into a pair of underpants and jeans. "Didn't you know?" I ask, keeping my voice light. "Surprise," I say. "I'm pregnant." "Kate," she says, shaking her head in dismay. She knows as well as I do that I'm not pregnant. She asks, "And what exactly are you going to say when he tests you at his office and it comes back negative?" My answer is immediate, because I've thought this through. "A false positive. Home pregnancy tests are good, but they're not foolproof. It happens," I say. Last night, I couldn't sleep. How can I possibly sleep with all that's happening? My mind was consumed with thoughts of Meredith and Delilah, wondering where they were. As I was sleeping in my bed, all I could think about was where they were sleeping, if they were sleeping. I thought about Shelby sleeping forever. I imagined what she must have gone through in the moments before she died. I wondered what exactly someone did to take her life. Was she stabbed? Shot? Suffocated? No one has said. My mind drifted then to the blood the police found in Josh and Meredith's garage. Was it Meredith's blood? Delilah's? How did it get there? My thoughts then shifted to Dr. Feingold, the malpractice suit, two figures hiding in the darkness of the Dickey's home that night, weeks ago when Cassandra saw. Was it Dr. Feingold that she saw? Did he do something to Meredith and Delilah? At some point in the middle of the night, I knew that I needed to meet this man. I need to see for myself if he's someone capable of murder. "Then I'm going with you," Bea decides. "You can't," I say. "Why the hell not?" she asks. She's angry because she's worried for me. "Because two women can't conceive on their own,"
I say. It would raise questions. Dr. Feingold would want to know why we didn't just go see our fertility specialist if we were pregnant.
We don't have to tell him we're gay, she says. We'll tell him I'm